28. "His name is Jackson," Webster said.
"How long has he been in there?"
Milosevic asked. "Nearly a year," Webster said. 11 o'clock in the morning, Thursday, July 3rd, inside Peterson. The section head at Quantico was faxing material over from Andrews down the Air Force's own secure fax network as fast as the machines could handle it. Milosevic and Brogan were pulling it off the machines and passing it to Webster and McGrath for analysis. On the other side of the table, General Johnson and his aide were scanning a map of the northwest corner of Montana. "You got people undercover in all these groups?" Johnson asked. Webster shook his head and smiled.
"Not all of them," he said. "Too many groups, not enough people. I think we just got lucky."
"I didn't know we had people in this one," Brogan said.
Webster was still smiling.
"Lots of things lots of people don't know," he said. "Safer that way, right?"
"So what is this Jackson guy saying?" Brogan asked.
"Does he mention Holly?" Johnson asked.
"Does he mention what the hell this is all about?"
Milosevic asked. Webster blew out his cheeks and waved his hand at the stack of curling fax paper. McGrath was busy sifting through it. He was separating the paper into two piles, one pile for routine stuff, the other pile for important intelligence. The routine pile was bigger. The important intelligence was sketchy.
"Analysis, Mac?" Webster said.
McGrath shrugged.
"Up to a point, pretty much normal," he said.
Johnson stared at him.
"Normal," he said.
Webster nodded.
"This is normal," he said. "We got these militia groups all over the country, which is why we can't cover them all. Too damn many. Our last count was way over 400 groups, all 50 states. Most of them are just amateur wackos, but some of them we consider pretty serious anti-government terrorists."
"This bunch?" Johnson asked. McGrath looked at him.
"This bunch is totally serious," he said. 100 people hidden out in the forest, very well-armed, very organized, very self-contained, very well-funded, too. Jackson has reported mail fraud, phony bank drafts, a little low-grade counterfeiting, probably armed robbery as well. The feeling is they stole $20 million in bearer bonds, armored car heist up in the north of California. And, of course, they're selling videos and books and manuals to the rest of the wackos, mail order. Big boom industry right now. And naturally, they declined to pay income tax or license their vehicles or anything else that might cost them anything."
"Effectively, they control York County," Webster said.
"How is that possible?"
Johnson asked.
"Because nobody else does," Webster said. "You ever been up there?"
I haven't. Jackson says the whole place is abandoned. Everything pulled out a long time ago. He says there's just a couple dozen citizens still around, spread out over miles of empty territory. Bankrupt ranchers, leftover miners, old folk. No effective county government. Borkin just eased his way in and took it over."
"He's calling it an experiment," McGrath said. "A prototype for a brand new nation."
Johnson nodded blankly.
"But what about Holly?" he said.
Webster stacked the paper and laid his hand on it.
"He doesn't mention her," he said. "His last call was Monday, the day she was grabbed up. They were building a prison. We have to assume it was for her."
"This guy calls in?" Brogan said.
"By radio?"
Webster nodded.
"He's got a transmitter concealed in the forest," he said. "He wanders off when he can, calls in. That's why it's all so erratic. He's been averaging one call a week. He's pretty inexperienced, and he's been told to be cautious. We assume he's under surveillance. Brave new world up there, that's for damn sure."
"Can we call him?"
Milosevic asked.
"You're kidding," Webster said. "We just sit and wait."
"Who does he report to?"
Brogan asked.
"Resident agent at Butte," Webster said.
"So, what do we do?" Johnson asked. Webster shrugged. The room went quiet.
Right now, nothing, he said. We need a position. The room stayed quiet, and Webster just looked hard at Johnson. It was a look between one government man and another, and it said, you know how it is. Johnson stared back for a long time, expressionless. Then his head moved through a fractional nod, just enough to say, for the moment, I know how it is. Johnson's aide coughed into the silence. We've got missiles north of York, he said. They're moving south right now on their way back here. 20 grunts, 100 stingers, 5 trucks. They'll be heading straight through York any time now. Can we use them? Brogan shook his head. Against the law, he said. Military can't participate in law enforcement. Webster ignored him and glanced at Johnson and waited. They were his men, and Holly was his daughter. The answer was better coming straight from him. There was a silence, and then Johnson shook his head. No, he said. We need time to plan. The aide spread his hands wide. We can plan, he said. We've got radio contact ground to ground. We should go for it, General. Against the law, Brogan said again. Johnson made no reply. He was thinking hard. McGrath ripped through the pile of paper and pulled the sheet about the dynamite packing Holly's prison walls. He held it face down on the shiny table. But Johnson shook his head again. No, he said again. 20 men against 100? They're not frontline troops. They're not infantry. And their stingers won't help us. I assume these terrorists don't have an air force, right? No, we wait. Bring the missile unit right back here, fastest. No engagement. The aide shrugged, and McGrath slipped the dynamite report back into the pile. Webster looked around and slapped both palms lightly on the tabletop. I'm going back to D.C., he said. Got to get a position. Johnson shrugged his shoulders. He knew nothing could start without a trip back to D.C. to get a position. Webster turned to McGrath. You three move up to Butte, he said. Get settled in the office there. If this guy Jackson calls, put him on maximum alert. We can chopper you up there, the aide said. And we need surveillance, Webster said. Can you get the Air Force to put some camera planes over York? Johnson nodded. They'll be there, he said. 24 hours a day. We'll give you a live video feed into Butte. A rat farts, you'll see it. No intervention, Webster said. Not yet. 29. She heard footsteps in the corridor at the exact moment the sixth bolt came free. A light tread. Not Jackson. Not a man treading carefully. A woman walking normally. The steps halted outside her door. There was a pause. She rested the long tube back on the frame. A key went into the lock. She pulled the mattress back into place, dragged the blanket over it. Another pause. The door opened. A woman came into the room. She looked like all of them looked. White, lean, long, straight hair, strong, plain face. No makeup, no adornment. Red hands. She was carrying a tray with a white cloth mounded up over it. No weapon. Lunch, she said. Holly nodded. Her heart was pounding. The woman was standing there, the tray in her hands, looking around the room, staring hard at the new pine walls. Where do you want this? She asked. On the bed? Holly shook her head. On the floor, she said. The woman bent and placed the tray on the floor. Guess you could use a table, she said, and a chair. Holly glanced down at the flatware and thought, tools. You want me to get them to bring you a chair? The woman asked. No, Holly said. Well, I could use one, the woman said. I've got to wait and watch you eat. Make sure you don't steal the silverware. Holly nodded vaguely and circled around the woman, glanced at the open door. The woman followed her gaze and grinned. Nowhere to run, she said. We're a long way from anywhere, and there's some difficult terrain in the way. North,
you'd reach Canada in a couple of weeks if you found enough roots and berries and bugs to eat. West, you'd have to swim the river. East, you'd get lost in the forest or eaten by a bear, and even if you didn't, you're still a month away from Montana. South, we'd shoot you. The border is crawling with guards. You wouldn't stand a chance.
The road is blocked? Holly asked. The woman smiled.
We blew the bridge, she said. There is no road. Not anymore.
When?
Holly asked her. We drove in.
Just now, the woman said. You didn't hear it?
Huh. I guess you wouldn't now with these walls.
So how does Reacher get sent out? Holly asked. He's supposed to be carrying some sort of a message.
The woman smiled again.
That plan has changed, she said. Mission canceled. He's not going.
Why not? Holly asked. The woman looked straight at her.
We found out what happened to Peter Bell, she said.
Holly went quiet.
Reacher killed him, the woman said. Suffocated him.
In North Dakota, we were just informed.
But I expect you know all about it.
Right. Holly stared at her. She thought, Reacher's in big trouble. She saw him, handcuffed and alone somewhere.
How did you find out? She asked quietly.
The woman shrugged.
We have a lot of friends, she said.
Holly kept on staring at her. She thought, the mole. They know we were in North Dakota. Takes a map and a ruler to figure out where we are now. She saw computer keyboards clicking and Jackson's name scrolling up on a dozen screens.
What's going to happen to Reacher? She asked. A life for a life, the woman said. That's the rule here. Same for your friend Reacher as for anybody else.
But what's going to happen to him? Holly asked again. The woman laughed.
Doesn't take much imagination, she said. Or maybe it does. I don't expect it's going to be anything real simple.
Holly shook her head.
It was self-defense, she said. The guy was trying to rape me.
The woman looked at her scornfully.
So how is that self-defense? She said. Wasn't trying to rape him, was he? And you were probably asking for it anyhow.
What? Holly said.
Shaking your tail at him? The woman said. We know all about smart little city bitches like you. Poor old Peter never stood a chance.
Holly just stared at her. Then she glanced at the door.
Where is Reacher now? She asked. No idea, the woman said. Chained to a tree somewhere, I guess.
Then she grinned.
But I know where he's going, she said. The parade ground. That's where they usually do that sort of stuff. We're all ordered up there to watch the fun.
Holly stared at her. Then she swallowed. Then she nodded.
Will you help me with this bed? She asked. Something wrong with it.
The woman paused, then she followed her over.
What's wrong with it? She asked.
Holly pulled the blanket back and heaved the mattress onto the floor.
The bolts seem a little loose, she said. Where?
The woman said.
Here,
Holly said. She used both hands on the long tube, whipped it upward and spun and smashed it like a blunt spear into the side of the woman's head. The flange hit her like a metal fist. Skin tore, and a neat rectangle of bone punched deep into her brain, and she bounced off the mattress and was dead before she hit the floor. Holly stepped carefully over the tray of lunch and limped calmly toward the open door. 30. Harland Webster got back to the Hoover Building from Colorado at 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon, East Coast time. He went straight to his office suite and checked his messages. Then he buzzed his secretary. Car, he said. He went down in his private elevator to the garage and met his driver. They walked over to the limousine and got in.
White House, Webster said. You seeing the president, sir?
The driver asked, surprised. Webster scowled forward at the back of the guy's head.
He wasn't seeing the president. He didn't see the president very often. He didn't need reminding of that, especially not by a damn driver sounding all surprised that there even was such a possibility. "Attorney General," he said. "White House is where she is right now." His driver nodded silently, cursed himself for opening his big mouth, drove on smoothly and unobtrusively. The distance between the Hoover Building and the White House was exactly 1,600 yards, less than a mile, not even far enough to click over the little number in the speedometer on the limousine's dash. It would have been quicker to walk, and cheaper. Firing up the cold V8 and hauling all that bulletproof plating 1,600 yards really ate up the gas. But the director couldn't walk anywhere. Theory was he'd get assassinated. Fact was, there were probably about 8 people in the city who would recognize him. Just another D.C. guy in a gray suit and a quiet tie. Anonymous. Another reason old Webster was never in the best of tempers, his driver thought. Webster knew the Attorney General pretty well. She was his boss, but his familiarity with her did not come from their face-to-face meetings. It came instead from the background checks the Bureau had run prior to her confirmation. Webster probably knew more about her than anybody else on Earth did. Her parents and friends and ex-colleagues all knew their own separate perspectives. Webster had put all of those together, and he knew the whole picture. Her bureau file took up as much disk space as a short novel. Nothing at all in the file made him dislike her. She had been a lawyer, faintly radical at the start of her career, built up a decent practice, grabbed a judgeship, never annoyed the law enforcement community without ever becoming a rabid, foaming-at-the-mouth pain in the ass. An ideal appointment, sailed through her confirmation with no problem at all. Since then, she had proven to be a good boss and a great ally. Her name was Ruth Rosen, and the only problem Webster had with her was that she was 12 years younger than him, very good-looking, and a whole lot more famous than he was. His appointment was for 4 o'clock. He found Rosen alone in a small room, 2 floors and 8 Secret Service agents away from the Oval Office. She greeted him with a strained smile and an urgent inclination of her elegant head. "Holly?" she asked. He nodded. He gave her the spread, top to bottom. She listened hard and ended up pale, with her lips clamped tight. "We totally sure this is where she is?" she asked. He nodded again. "Sure as we can be," he said. "Okay," she said. "Wait there, will you?" She left the small room. Webster waited. 10 minutes, then 20, then a half hour. He paced. He gazed out of the window. He opened the door and glanced out into the corridor. A Secret Serviceman glanced back at him, took a pace forward. Webster shook his head in answer to the question the guy hadn't asked and closed the door again. Just sat down and waited. Ruth Rosen was gone an hour. She came back in and closed the door. Then she just stood there, a yard inside the small room, pale, breathing hard, some kind of shock on her face. She said nothing, just let it dawn on him that there was some kind of a big problem happening.
"What?" he asked.
"I'm out of the loop on this," she said.
"What?"
he asked again. "They took me out of the loop," she said. "My reactions were wrong. Dexter is handling it from here."
"Dexter," he repeated.
Dexter was the president's White House chief of staff, a political fixer from the old school, as hard as a nail and half as sentimental. But he was the main reason the president was sitting there in the Oval Office with a big majority of the popular vote. "I'm very sorry, Harland," Ruth Rosen said. "He'll be here in a minute." He nodded sourly, and she went back out the door and left him to wait again. The relationship between the rest of the FBI and the field office in Butte, Montana, is similar to the relationship between Moscow and Siberia, proverbially speaking. It's a standard bureau joke. Screw up, the joke goes, and you'll be working out of Butte tomorrow, like some kind of an internal exile, like KGB follow-ups were supposedly sent out to write parking tickets in Siberia. But on that Thursday, July 3rd, the field office in Butte felt like the center of the universe for McGrath and Milosevic and Brogan. It felt like the most desirable posting in the world. None of the three had ever been there before, not on business, not on vacation. None of them would have ever considered going there. But now they were peering out of the Air Force helicopter like kids on their way to the Magic Kingdom. They were looking at the landscape below and swiveling their gaze northwest toward where they knew York County was hiding under the distant, hazy mist. The resident agent at Butte was a competent bureau veteran, still reeling after a personal call from Harland Webster, direct from the Hoover Building. His instructions were to drive the three Chicago agents to his office, brief them on the way, get them installed, rent them a couple of jeeps, and then get the hell out and stay the hell out until further notice. So he was waiting at the Silver Bow County Airport when the dirty, black Air Force chopper clattered in. He piled the agents into his government Buick and blasted back north to town.
Distances are big around here, he said to McGrath. Don't ever forget that. We're still 240 miles shy of York. On our roads, that's 4 hours, absolute minimum. Me, I'd get some mobile units and move up a lot closer. Basing yourselves down here won't help you much, not if things start to turn bad up there.
McGrath nodded. You hear from Jackson again? He asked.
Not since Monday, the resident agent said. The dynamite thing.
Next time he calls, he speaks to me, okay? McGrath said.
The Butte guy nodded, fished one-handed in his pocket while he drove, pulled out a small radio receiver. McGrath took it from him, put it into his own pocket.
Be my guest, the Butte guy said. I'm on vacation. Webster's orders. But don't hold your breath. Jackson doesn't call often. He's very cautious.
The field office was just a single room, second floor of a two-floor municipal building. A desk, two chairs, a computer, a big map of Montana on the wall, a lot of filing space, and a ringing telephone. McGrath answered it. He listened and grunted, hung up and waited for the resident agent to take the hint.
Okay, I'm gone, the old guy said.
Silver Bow Jeep will bring you a couple of vehicles over. Anything else you guys need?
Privacy, Brogan said.
The old guy nodded and glanced around his office. Then he was gone.
Air Force has put a couple of spy planes up there, McGrath said. Satellite gear is coming in by road. The general and his aide are coming here. Looks like they're going to be our guests for the duration. Can't really argue with that, right?
Milosevic was studying the map on the wall.
Wouldn't want to argue with that, he said. We're going to need some favors. You guys ever seen a worse-looking place?
McGrath and Brogan joined him in front of the map. Milosevic's finger was planted on York. Ferocious green and brown terrain boiled all around it.
4,000 square miles, Milosevic said.
One road and one track.
They chose a good spot, Brogan said.
I spoke with the president, Dexter said. He sat back and paused. Webster stared at him.
What the hell else would he have been doing? Pruning the rose garden?
Dexter was staring back. He was a small guy, burned up, dark, twisted, the way a person gets to look after spending every minute of every day figuring every possible angle. And? Webster said.
There are 66 million gun owners in this country, Dexter said.
So? Webster asked.
Our analysts think they all share certain basic sympathies, Dexter said.
What analysts? Webster said. What sympathies?
There was a poll, Dexter said. Did we send you a copy? One adult in five would be willing to take up arms against the government if strictly necessary.
So? Webster asked again.
There was another poll, Dexter said. A simple question to be answered intuitively, from the gut. Who's in the right, the government or the militias?
And, Webster said,
12 million Americans sided with the militias, Dexter said. Webster stared at him, waited for the message. So, Dexter said, somewhere between 12 and 66 million voters.
What about them? Webster asked.
And where are they? Dexter asked back.
You won't find many of them in D.C. or New York or Boston or L.A. It's a skewed sample. Some places they're a tiny minority. They look like weirdos. But other places, they're a majority. Other places, they're absolutely normal, Harland.
So, he said. Some places they control counties, Dexter said. Even states.
Webster stared at him.
God's sake, Dexter. This isn't politics, he said. This is Holly.
Dexter paused and glanced around the small White House room. It was painted a subtle off-white. It had been painted and repainted that same subtle color every few years while presidents came and went. He smiled a connoisseur's smile.
Unfortunately, everything's politics, he said.
This is Holly, Webster said again.
Dexter shook his head, just a slight movement.
This is emotion, he said. Think about innocent little emotional words like patriot, resistance, crush, underground, struggle, oppression, individual, distrust, rebel, revolt, revolution, rights. There's a certain majesty to these words, don't you think, in an American context?
Webster shook his head doggedly.
Nothing majestic about kidnapping women, he said. Nothing majestic about illegal weapons, illegal armies, stolen dynamite. This isn't politics.
Dexter shook his head again, the same slight movement.
Things have a way of becoming politics, he said. Think about Ruby Ridge. Think about Waco, Harland. That wasn't politics, right? But it became politics pretty damn soon. We hurt ourselves with maybe 66 million voters there, and we were real dumb about it. Big reactions are what these people want. They figure that harsh reprisals will upset people, bring more people into their fold. And we gave them big reactions. We fueled their fire. We made it look like big government was just about itching to crush the little guy.
The room went silent.
The polls say we need a better approach, Dexter said. And we're trying to find one.
We're trying real hard.
So how would it look if the White House stopped trying just because it happens to be Holly who's involved? And right now, the 4th of July weekend. Don't you understand anything? Think about it, Harland. Think about the reaction. Think about words like vindictive, self-interested, revenge, personal, words like that, Harland. Think about what words like those are going to do to our poll numbers.
Webster stared at him. The off-white walls crushed in on him.
This is about Holly, for God's sake, he said. This is not about poll numbers. And what about the general? Has the president said all this to him?
Dexter shook his head.
I've said it all to him, he said. Personally, a dozen times. He's been calling every hour on the hour.
Webster thought, now the president won't even take Johnson's calls anymore. Dexter has really fixed him.
And? He asked. Dexter shrugged.
I think he understands the principle, he said. But naturally, his judgment is kind of colored right now. He's not a happy man.
Webster lapsed into silence, started thinking hard. He was a smart enough bureaucrat to know if you can't beat them, you join them. You force yourself to think like they think.
But busting her out could do you good, he said. A lot of good. It would look tough, decisive, loyal, no nonsense, could be advantageous in the polls.
Dexter nodded.
I totally agree with you, he said. But it's a gamble, right? A real big gamble. A quick victory is good, a foul-up is a disaster. A big gamble with big poll numbers at stake. And right now, I'm doubting if you can get the quick victory. Right now, you're half-cocked. So right now, my money would be on the foul-up.
Webster stared at him.
Pay no offense, Harland, Dexter said. I'm paid to think like this, right?
So what the hell are you saying here? Webster asked him. I need to move the hostage rescue team into place right now.
No, Dexter said. No?
Webster repeated incredulously. Dexter shook his head.
Permission denied, he said. For the time being.
Webster just stared at him. I need a position, he said. The room stayed silent. Then Dexter spoke to a spot on the off-white wall, a yard to the left of Webster's chair.
You remain in personal command of the situation, he said. Holiday weekend starts tomorrow. Come talk to me Monday, if there's still a problem.
There's a problem now, Webster said, and I'm talking to you now.
Dexter shook his head again. No, you're not, he said. We didn't meet today, and I didn't speak with the president today. We didn't know anything about it today. Tell us all about it on Monday, Harland, if there's still a problem.
Webster just sat there. He was a smart enough guy, but right then he couldn't figure if he was being handed the deal of a lifetime or a suicide pill.
Johnson and his aide arrived in Butte an hour later. They came in the same way, Air Force helicopter from Peterson up to the Silver Bow County Airport. Milosevic took an air-to-ground call as they were on approach, and went out to meet them in a 2-year-old Grand Cherokee supplied by the local dealership. Nobody spoke on the short ride back to town. Milosevic just drove, and the two military men bent over charts and maps from a large leather case the aide was carrying. They passed them back and forth and nodded, as if further comment was unnecessary. The upstairs room in the municipal building was suddenly crowded. 5 men, 2 chairs. The only window faced southeast over the street, the wrong direction. The 5 men were instinctively glancing at the blank wall opposite. Through that wall was Holly, 240 miles away.
We're going to have to move up there, General Johnson said. His aide nodded. No good staying here, he said.
McGrath had made a decision. He had promised himself he wouldn't fight turf wars with these guys. His agent was Johnson's daughter. He understood the old guy's feelings. He wasn't going to squander time and energy proving who was boss, and he needed the old guy's help.
We need to share facilities, he said, just for the time being.
There was a short silence. The general nodded slowly. He knew enough about Washington to decode those 5 words with a fair degree of accuracy.
I don't have many facilities available, he said in turn. It's the holiday weekend. Exactly 75% of the U.S. Army is on leave.
Silence.
McGrath's turn to do the decoding and the slow nodding.
No authorization to cancel leave? He asked.
The general shook his head. I just spoke with Dexter, he said, and Dexter just spoke with the president. Feeling was, this thing is on hold until Monday. The crowded room went silent. The guy's daughter was in trouble, and the White House fixer was playing politics.
Webster got the same story, McGrath said. Can't even bring the hostage rescue team up here yet. Time being, we're on our own, the three of us.
The general nodded to McGrath. It was a personal gesture, individual to individual, and it said, we've leveled with each other, and we both know what humiliation that cost us, and we both know we appreciate it.
But there's no harm in being prepared, the general said. Like the little guy suspects, the military is comfortable with secret maneuvers. I'm calling in a few private favors that Mr. Dexter need never know about.
The silence in the room eased. McGrath looked a question at him.
There's a mobile command post already on its way, the general said. He took a large chart from his aide and spread it out on the desk. We're going to rendezvous right here, he said.
He had his finger on a spot northwest of the last habitation in Montana, short of York. It was a wide curve on the road leading into the county, about 6 miles shy of the bridge over the ravine.
The satellite trucks are heading straight there, he said. I figure we move in, set up the command post, and seal off the road behind us.
McGrath stood still, looking down at the map. He knew that to agree was to hand over total control to the military. He knew that to disagree was to play petty games with his agent and this man's daughter. Then he saw that the general's finger was resting a half inch south of a much better location. A little farther north, the road narrowed dramatically. It straightened to give a clear view north and south. The terrain tightened. A better site for a roadblock, a better site for a command post. He was amazed that the general hadn't spotted it. Then he was flooded with gratitude. The general had spotted it, but he was leaving room for McGrath to point it out. He was leaving room for give and take. He didn't want total control.
I would prefer this place, McGrath said.
He tapped the northerly location with a pencil. The general pretended to study it. His aide pretended to be impressed.
Good thinking, the general said. We'll revise the rendezvous.
McGrath smiled. He knew damn well the trucks were already heading for that exact spot, probably already there. The general grinned back. The ritual dance was completed.
What can the spy plane show us? Brogan asked.
Everything, the general's aide said. Wait until you see the pictures. The cameras on those babies are unbelievable.
I don't like it, McGrath said. It's going to make them nervous.
The aide shook his head. They won't even know they're there, he said. We're using two of them, flying straight lines east to west and west to east. They're 37,000 feet up. Nobody on the ground is even going to be aware of them.
That's 7 miles up, Brogan said. How can they see anything from that sort of height?
Good cameras, the aide said.
7 miles is nothing. They'll show you a cigarette pack lying on the sidewalk from 7 miles. The whole thing is automatic. The guys up there hit a button, and the camera tracks whatever it's supposed to track. Just keeps pointing at the spot on the ground you chose, transmitting high-quality video by satellite. Then you turn around and come back, and the camera swivels around and does it all again.
Undetectable? McGrath asked.
They look like airliners, the aide said. You look up, and you see a tiny little vapor trail, and you think it's TWA on the way somewhere. You don't think it's the Air Force checking whether you polished your shoes this morning, right?
7 miles, you'll see the hairs on their heads, Johnson said. What do you think we spent all those defense dollars on, crop dusters?
McGrath nodded. He felt naked. Time being, he had nothing to offer except a couple of rental jeeps 2 years old waiting at the sidewalk.
We're getting a profile on this Borkin guy, he said. Shrinks at Quantico are working it up now.
We found Jack Reacher's old CO, Johnson said. He's doing desk duty in the Pentagon. He'll join us, give us the spread. McGrath nodded.
Forewarned is forearmed, he said.
The telephone rang. Johnson's aide picked it up. He was the nearest.
"When are we leaving?"
Brogan asked. McGrath noticed he had asked Johnson direct.
"Right now, I guess," Johnson said. "The Air Force will fly us up there. Saves 6 hours on the road, right?"
The aide hung up the phone. He looked like he'd been kicked in the gut.
"The missile unit?" he said. "We lost radio contact north of York."
31. Holly paused in the corridor, smiled. The woman had left her weapon propped against the wall outside the door. That had been the delay. She had used the key, put the tray on the floor, unslung her weapon, propped it against the wall, and picked up the tray again before nudging open the door. She swapped the iron tube for the gun. Not a weapon she had used before, not one she wanted to use now. It was a tiny submachine gun, an Ingram Mach-10, obsolete military issue. Obsolete for a reason. Holly's class at Quantico had laughed about it. They called it the phone booth gun. It was so inaccurate you had to be in a phone booth with your guy to be sure of hitting him. A grim joke. And it fired way too quickly, 1,000 rounds per minute. One touch on the trigger and the magazine was empty. But it was a better weapon than part of an old iron bed frame. She checked the magazine. It was full, 30 shells. The chamber was clean. She clicked the trigger and watched the mechanism move. The gun worked as well as it was ever going to. She smacked the magazine back into position, straightened the canvas strap and slung it tight over her shoulder, clicked the cocking handle to the fire position and closed her hand around the grip, took a firm hold on her crutch and eased to the top of the stairs. She stood still and waited, listened hard. No sound. She went down the stairs, slowly, a step at a time, the Ingram out in front of her. At the bottom, she waited and listened again. No sound. She crossed the lobby and arrived at the doors, eased them open, and looked outside. The street was deserted, but it was wide. It looked like a huge city boulevard to her. To reach safety on the other side was going to take her minutes. Minutes out there in the open, exposed to the mountain slopes above. She estimated the distance, breathed hard and gripped her crutch, jabbed the Ingram forward, breathed hard again and took off at a lurching run, jamming the crutch down, leaping ahead with her good leg, swinging the gun left and right to cover both approaches. She threw herself at the mound in front of the ruined county office, scrabbled north around behind it and fought through grabbing undergrowth, entered the forest parallel to the main track but 30 yards from it, leaned on a tree and bent double, gasping with exertion and fear and exhilaration. This was the real thing. This was what the whole of her life had led her to. She could hear her father's war stories in her head, the jungles of Vietnam, the breathless fear of being hunted in the green undergrowth, the triumph of each safe step, of each yard gained. She saw the faces of the tough, quiet men she had known on the bases as a child, the instructors at Quantico. She felt the disappointment of her posting to a safe desk in Chicago, all the training wasted because of who she was. Now it was different. She straightened up, took a deep breath, then another. She felt her genes boiling through her. Before, they'd felt like resented intruders. Now they felt warm and whole and good. Her father's daughter? You bet your ass. Reacher was cuffed around the trunk of a 100-foot pine. He had been dragged down the narrow track to the bastion, burning with fury. One punch and one kick was more than he had yielded since his early childhood. The rage was burying the pain and blurring his mind. A life for a life, the fat bastard had said. Reacher had twisted on the floor and the words had meant nothing to him. But they meant something now. They had come back to him as he stood there. Men and women had strolled up to him and smiled. Their smiles were the sort of smiles he had seen before, long ago. The smiles of bored children living on an isolated base somewhere, after they had been told the circus was coming to town.
She thought hard. She had to guess where he was, and she had to guess where the parade ground was. She had to get herself halfway between those two unknown locations and set up an ambush. She knew the ground sloped steeply up to the clearing with the huts. She remembered being brought downhill to the courthouse. She guessed the parade ground had to be a large, flat area. Therefore, it had to be farther uphill, to the northwest, where the ground leveled out in the mountain bowl, some distance beyond the huts. She set off uphill through the trees. She tried to figure out where the main path was running. Every few yards, she stopped and peered south, turning left and right to catch a glimpse of the gaps in the forest canopy where the trees had been cleared. That way, she could deduce the direction of the track. She kept herself parallel to it, 30 or 40 yards away to the north, and fought through the tough, whippy stems growing sideways from the trunks. It was all uphill and steep, and it was hard work. She used her crutch like a boatman uses a pole, planting it securely in the soil and thrusting herself upward against it. In a way, her knee helped her. It made her climb slowly and carefully. It made her quiet. And she knew how to do this, from old Vietnam stories, not from Quantico. The Academy had concentrated on urban situations. The Bureau had taught her how to stalk through a city street or a darkened building. How to stalk through a forest came from an earlier layer of memory. Some people strolled up and strolled away, but some of them stayed. After a quarter hour, there was a small crowd of maybe 15 or 16 people, mostly men, standing aimlessly in a wide semicircle around him. They kept their distance, like rubberneckers at a car wreck, behind an invisible police line. They stared at him, silently, not much in their faces. He stared back. He let his gaze rest on each one in turn, several seconds at a time. He kept his arms hitched as high behind him as he could manage. He wanted to keep his feet free for action, in case any of them felt like starting the show a little early. She smelled the first sentry before she saw him. He was moving upwind toward her, smoking. The odor of the cigarette and the unwashed uniform drifted down to her, and she pulled silently to her right. She looped a wide circle around him and waited. He walked on down the hill and was gone. The second sentry heard her. She sensed it. Sensed him stopping and listening. She stood still, thought hard. She didn't want to use the Ingram. It was too inaccurate. She was certain to miss with it, and the noise would be fatal. So she bent down and scratched up two small stones, an old jungle trick she had been told about as a child. She tossed the first stone 20 feet to her left, waited, tossed the second 30 feet. She heard the sentry figure something was moving slowly away to the left, heard him drift in that direction. She drifted right, a wide circle, and onward, up the endless hill. Fowler shouldered through the small semicircle of onlookers, stepped up face to face with him, stared hard at him. Then 6 guards were coming through the crowd. 5 of them had rifles leveled, and the 6th had a length of chain in his hand. Fowler stood aside, and the 5 rifles jammed hard into Reacher's gut. He glanced down at them. The safety catches were off, and they were all set to automatic fire.
"Time to go," Fowler said.
He vanished behind the sturdy trunk, and Reacher felt the cuffs come off. He leaned forward off the tree, and the muzzles tracked back, following the motion. Then the cuffs went back on, with the chain looped into them. Fowler gripped the chain, and Reacher was dragged through the bastion, facing the 5 guards. They were all walking backward, their rifles leveled 1 foot from his head. People were lined into a tight cordon. He was dragged between them. The people hissed and muttered at him as he passed. Then they broke ranks and ran ahead of him, up toward the parade ground. The 3rd sentry caught her. Her knee let her down. She had to scale a high, rocky crag, and because of her leg, she had to do it backward.
She sat on the rock like it was a chair and used her good leg and the crutch to push herself upward, a foot at a time. She reached the top and rolled over on her back on the ground, gasping from the effort, and then she squirmed upright and stood face to face with the sentry. For a split second, she was blank with surprise and shock. He wasn't. He had stood at the top of the bluff and watched every inch of her agonizing progress, so he wasn't surprised. But he was slow. An opponent like Holly, he should have been quick. He should have been ready. Her reaction clicked in before he could get started. Basic training took over. It came without thinking. She balled her fist and threw a fast, low uppercut, caught him square in the groin. He folded forward and down, and she wrapped her left arm around his throat and crunched him in the back of his neck with her right forearm. She felt his vertebrae smash and his body go slack. Then she clamped her palms over his ears and twisted his head around, savagely, one way and then the other. His spinal cord severed, and she turned him and dropped him over the crag. He thumped and crashed his way down over the rocks, dead limbs flailing. Then she cursed and swore, bitterly, because she should have taken his rifle. It was worth a dozen Ingrams. But there was no way she was going to climb all the way down to get it. Climbing back up again would delay her too long. The parade ground was full of people, all standing in neat ranks. Reacher guessed there were maybe 100 people there, men and women, all in uniform, all armed. Their weapons formed a formidable array of firepower. Each person had either a fully automatic rifle or a machine gun slung over their left shoulder. Each person had an automatic pistol on their belt. They all had ammunition pouches and grenades hung regulation style from loops on their webbing. Many of them had smeared night camouflage on their faces. Their uniforms were adapted from U.S. Army surplus. Camouflage jackets, camouflage pants, jungle boots, forage caps, same stuff as Reacher had seen piled up in the storehouse. But each uniform had additions. Each jacket had an immaculate shoulder flash woven in maroon silk, spelling out Montana Militia in an elegant curve. Each jacket had the wearer's name stenciled onto olive tape and sewn above the breast pocket. Some of the men had single chromium stars punched through the fabric on the breast pocket, some kind of rank. Bo Borkin was standing on an upturned wooden crate, west edge of the leveled area, his back to the forest, his massive bulk looming over his troops. He saw Fowler and Reacher and the guards arriving through the trees.
"Attend! Hut!"
he called. There was a shuffling as the 100 militia members snapped into position. Reacher caught a smell of canvas on the breeze, the smell of 100 Army surplus uniforms. Borkin waved a bloated arm, and Fowler used the chain to drag Reacher up toward the front of the gathering. The guards seized his arms and shoulders, and he was turned and maneuvered so he was left standing next to the box, suddenly isolated, facing the crowd.
"We all know why we're here," Borkin called out to them.
She had no idea how far she had come. It felt like miles, hundreds of feet uphill, but she was still deep in the woods. The main track was still 40 yards south on her left. She felt the minutes ticking away and her panic rising. She gripped the crutch and moved on northwest again as fast as she dared. Then she saw a building ahead of her, a wooden hut visible through the trees. The undergrowth petered out into stony shale. She crept to the edge of the wood and stopped, listened hard over the roar of her breathing, heard nothing. She gripped the crutch and raised the Ingram tight against the strap, limped across the shale to the corner of the hut, looked out and around. It was the clearing where they had arrived the night before, a wide, circular space, stony, ringed with huts, deserted, quiet. The absolute silence of a recently abandoned place. She came out from behind the hut and limped to the center of the clearing, pirouetting on her crutch, jabbing the Ingram in a wide circle,
covering the trees on the perimeter. Nothing. Nobody there. She saw two paths, one running west, a wider track running north. She swung north and headed back into the cover of the trees. She forgot all about trying to stay quiet and raced north as fast as she could move.
"We all know why we're here,"
Borkin called out again. The orderly crowd shuffled, and a wave of whispering rose to the trees. Reacher scanned the faces. He saw Stevie in the front rank, a chromium star through his breast pocket. Little Stevie was an officer. Next to Stevie, he saw Joseph Ray. Then he realized Jackson was not there. No scarred forehead. He double-checked. Scanned everywhere. No sign of him anywhere on the parade ground. He clamped his teeth to stop a smile. Jackson was hiding out. Holly might still make it. She saw him. She stared out of the forest over 100 heads and saw him standing next to Borkin. His arms were cuffed behind him. He was scanning the crowd. Nothing in his face. She heard Borkin say, "We all know why we're here." She thought, "Yes, I know why I'm here. I know exactly why I'm here." She looked left and right. 100 people. Rifles, machine guns, pistols, grenades. Borkin on the box with his arms raised, Reacher helpless beside him. She stood in the trees, heart thumping, staring. Then she took a deep breath, set the Ingram to the single-shot position, and fired into the air. Burst out of the trees, fired again, and again, 3 shots into the air, 3 bullets gone, 27 left in the magazine. She clicked the Ingram back to full auto and moved into the crowd, parting it in front of her with slow, menacing sweeps of her gun hand. She was one woman moving slowly through a crowd of 100 people. They parted warily around her, and then, as she passed them by, they unslung their weapons and cocked them and leveled them at her back. A wave of loud, mechanical noises trailed behind her like a slow tide. By the time she reached the front rank, she had 100 loaded weapons trained on her from behind.
"Don't shoot her!"
Borkin screamed.
"That's an order! Nobody fire!"
He jumped down off the box, panic in his face. He raised his arms out wide and danced desperately around her, shielding her body with his huge bulk. Nobody fired. She limped away from him and turned to face the crowd.
"Hell are you doing?"
Borkin screamed at her.
"You think you can shoot 100 people with that little pop gun?"
Holly shook her head.
"No,"
she said quietly. Then she reversed the Ingram and held it to her chest.
"But I can shoot myself," she said.
32. The crowd was silent. Their breathing was swallowed up by the awesome mountain silence. Everybody was staring at Holly. She was holding the Ingram reversed, the muzzle jammed into a spot above her heart, thumb backward on the trigger, tensed. Borkin's bloated face was greased with panic. His huge frame was shaking and trembling. He was hopping around next to his upturned box, staring wide-eyed at her. She was looking back at him, calmly.
"I'm a hostage, right?" she said to him. "Important to them, important to you because of who I am. All kinds of importance to all kinds of people. You expect them to do stuff to keep me alive. So now it's your turn. Let's talk about what stuff you're prepared to do to keep me alive."
Borkin saw her glance at Reacher.
"You don't understand!"
he screamed at her, wild urgency in his voice.
"I'm not going to kill this guy! This guy stays alive! The situation has changed!"
"Changed how?" she asked calmly.
"I'm commuting his sentence,"
Borkin said, still panic in his voice.
"That's why we're here. I was just going to announce it. We know who he is. We just found out. We were just informed. He was in the army. Major Jack Reacher. He's a hero. He won the Silver Star."
"So?" Holly asked.
"He saved a bunch of Marines,"
Borkin said urgently.
in Beirut. Ordinary fighting men. He pulled them out of a burning bunker. Marines will never attack us while he's here. Never. So I'm going to use him as another hostage. He's good insurance against the damn Marines. I need him.
She stared at him. Reacher stared at him.
His sentence is commuted, Borkin said again. 5 years on punishment detail, that's all. Nothing else. No question about it. I need him alive.
He stared at her with a salesman's beam like the problem was solved. She stared back and forth between him and Reacher. Reacher was watching the crowd. The crowd was angry. The circus had left town before the performance. Reacher felt like they had all taken a step toward him. They were testing Borkin's power over them. Holly glanced at him, fear in her eyes, nodded to him, an imperceptible movement of her head. She would be safe, she was saying, whatever happened. Her identity protected her like an invisible magic cloak. Reacher nodded back. Without turning around, he judged the distance to the trees behind him. Maybe 20 feet. Shove Fowler at the front rank, drag the chain, sprint like hell. He might be in the trees before anybody could aim a weapon. 20 feet. Standing start, using the momentum of shouldering Fowler away to help him. Maybe 4 or 5 strides. Maybe 3 seconds. Maybe 4. In the trees, he would stand a chance against the bullets. He imagined them smacking into the trunks either side of him as he ran and dodged. A forest is a fugitive's best friend. It takes a lot of luck to hit a guy running through trees. He shifted his weight and felt his hamstrings tighten, felt the flood of adrenaline. Fight or flight. But then Borkin flung his arms wide again, held them out like an angel's wings, and used the awesome power of his eyes on his people.
I have made my decision, he called. Do you understand?
There was a long pause. It went on for seconds. Then 100 heads snapped back.
Yes, sir,
100 voices yelled.
Do you understand?
He called again. 100 heads snapped back again.
Yes, sir,
100 voices yelled.
5 years on punishment detail,
Borkin called.
But only if he can prove who he is. We are informed this man is the only non-Marine in history to win the Marine Sniper competition. We are told this man can put 6 bullets through a silver dollar 1,000 yards away. So I'm going to shoot against him. 800 yards. If he wins, he lives. If he loses, he dies. Do you understand?
100 heads snapped back.
Yes, sir,
100 voices yelled. The rumble from the crowd started up again. This time, they sounded interested. Reacher smiled inwardly. Smart move, he thought. They wanted a spectacle. Borkin was giving them one. Fowler breathed out and pulled a key from his pocket, ducked around and unlocked the handcuffs. The chain fell to the floor. Reacher breathed out and rubbed his wrists. Then Fowler stepped over to Holly in the press of people, stepped right in front of her. She paused for a long moment and glanced at Borkin. He nodded.
You have my word,
he said, with as much dignity as he could recover. She glanced at Reacher. He shrugged and nodded. She nodded back and looked down at the Ingram, clicked the safety on, and looped the strap off her shoulder, grinned, and dropped the gun to the floor. Fowler bent at her feet and scooped it up. Borkin raised his arms for quiet.
To the rifle range,
he called out.
Orderly fashion. Dismissed.
Holly limped over and walked next to Reacher.
You won the Wimbledon? She asked quietly.
He nodded.
So can you win this? She asked.
He nodded again. With my head in a bag, he said.
Is that such a good idea? She asked quietly. Guy like this, he's not going to be happy to get beat.
Reacher shrugged. He wants a big performance? He's going to get one, he said. He's all shaken up. You started it.
I want to keep it going. Long run, it'll do us good.
Well, take care, she said.
Watch me, Reacher said. Two brand new targets were placed side by side at the extreme end of the range. Borkins was on the left, with ATF daubed across its chest. Reacher's was on the right, with FBI over its heart. The rough matting was pulled back to give maximum distance. Reacher figured he was looking at about 830 yards, 50 yards shy of a full half mile. A hell of a long way. The swarm of people had settled into a rough semicircle behind and beside the matting. The nearer targets were flung into the undergrowth to clear their view. Several people had field glasses. They peered up the range, and then their noise faded as one after the other they settled into quiet anticipation. Fowler made the trip to the armory in the clearing below. He walked back with a rifle in each hand. One for Borkin, one for Reacher. Identical guns. The price of a small family car in each hand. They were 50 caliber Barrett Model 90s. Nearly 4 feet long, over 22 pounds in weight. Bolt action repeaters fired a bullet a full half inch across. More like an artillery shell than a rifle bullet.
One magazine each, Borkin said. 6 shots.
Reacher took his weapon and laid it on the ground at his feet. Little Stevie marshaled the crowd backward to clear the matting. Borkin checked his rifle and flicked the bipod legs out, smacked the magazine into place. He set the weapon down gently on the matting.
I shoot first, he said.
He dropped to his knees and forced his bulk down behind the rifle, pulled the stock to him and snuggled it in close, dragged the bipod legs an inch to the left and swung the butt a fraction to the right. He smacked the bolt in and out and pressed himself close to the ground, eased his cheek against the stock and put his eye to the scope. Joseph Ray stepped from the edge of the crowd and offered Reacher his field glasses. Reacher nodded silently and took them. Held him ready. Borkin's finger tightened against the trigger. He fired the first shot. The Barrett's huge muzzle brake blasted gas sideways and downward. Dust blasted back up off the matting. The rifle kicked and boomed. The sound crashed through the trees and came back off the mountains seconds later. 100 pairs of eyes flicked from Borkin to the target. Reacher raised the field glasses and focused 830 yards up the range. It was a miss. The target was undamaged. Borkin peered through the scope and grimaced. He hunkered down again and waited for the dust to clear. Reacher watched him. Borkin was just waiting, steady breathing, relaxed. Then his finger tightened again. He fired the second shot. The rifle kicked and crashed, and the dust blasted upward. Reacher raised the field glasses again. A hit. There was a splintered hole on the target's right shoulder. There was a murmur from the crowd. Field glasses were passed from hand to hand. The whispers rose and fell. The dust settled. Borkin fired again. Too quickly. He was still wriggling. Reacher watched him making the mistake. He didn't bother with the field glasses. He knew that half-inch shell would end up in Idaho. The crowd whispered. Borkin glared through the scope. Reacher watched him do it all wrong. His relaxation was disappearing. His shoulders were tensed. He fired the fourth. Reacher handed the field glasses back to Joseph Ray on the edge of the crowd. He didn't need to look. He knew Borkin was going to miss with the rest. In that state, he'd have missed at 400 yards. He'd have missed at 200. He'd have missed across a crowded room. Borkin fired the fifth and then the sixth and stood up slowly. He lifted the big rifle and used the scope to check what everybody already knew.
One hit, he said.
He lowered the rifle and looked across at Reacher.
Your shot, he said. Life or death?
Reacher nodded. Fowler handed him his magazine.
Reacher used his thumb to test the spring. He pressed down on the first bullet and felt the smooth return. The bullets were shiny, polished by hand, sniper's bullets. He bent and lifted the heavy rifle, held it vertical and clicked the magazine into place. He didn't smack at it, like Borkin had done. He pressed it home gently with his palm. He opened the bipod legs, one at a time, clicked them against their detents, glanced up the range and laid the rifle on the matting, squatted next to it and lay down all in one fluid motion. He lay like a dead man, arms flung upward around the gun. He wanted to lie like that for a long time. He was tired, deathly tired. But he stirred and laid his cheek gently against the stock, snuggled his right shoulder close to the butt, clamped his left hand over the barrel, fingers under the scope, eased his right hand toward the trigger, moved his right eye to the scope, breathed out. Firing a sniper rifle over a long distance is a confluence of many things. It starts with chemistry. It depends on mechanical engineering. It involves optics and geophysics and meteorology. Governing everything is human biology. The chemistry is about explosions. The powder behind the bullet in the shell case has to explode perfectly, predictably, powerfully, instantly. It has to smash the projectile down the barrel at maximum speed. The half-inch bullet in the Barrett chamber weighs a hair over 2 ounces. 1 minute, it's stationary. 1/1000th of a second later, it's doing nearly 1,900 miles an hour, leaving the barrel behind on its way to the target. That powder has to explode fast, explode completely, and explode hard. Difficult chemistry. Weight for weight, that explosion has got to be the best explosion on the planet. Then mechanical engineering takes over for a spell. The bullet itself has to be a perfect little artifact. It's got to be as good as any manufactured article has ever been. It has got to be cast better than any jewelry. It must be totally uniform in size and weight, perfectly round, perfectly streamlined. It has to accept ferocious rotation from the rifling grooves inside the barrel. It has to spin and hiss through the air with absolutely no wobble, no bias. The barrel has to be tight and straight. No good at all if a previous shot has heated and altered the barrel shape. The barrel has to be a mass of perfect metal, heavy enough to remain inert, heavy enough to kill the tiny vibrations of the bolt and the trigger and the firing pin. That's why the Barrett Reacher was holding cost as much as a cheap sedan. That's why Reacher's left hand was loosely clamped over the top of the gun. He was damping any residual shock with it. Optics play a big part. Reacher's right eye was an inch behind a Leupold and Stevens scope, a fine instrument. The target was showing small, behind the fine data lines etched into the glass. Reacher stared hard at it. Then he eased the stock down and saw the target disappear and the sky swim into view. He breathed out again and stared at the air. Because geophysics are crucial. Light travels in a straight line, but it's the only thing that does. Bullets don't. Bullets are physical things which obey the laws of nature like any other physical things. They follow the curvature of the earth. 830 yards is a significant piece of curvature. The bullet comes out of the barrel and rises above the line of sight. Then it passes through it. Then it falls below it, in a perfect curve, like the earth. Except it's not a perfect curve, because the very first millisecond the bullet is gone, gravity is plucking at it like a small insistent hand. The bullet can't ignore it. It's a 2-ounce copper-jacketed lead projectile traveling at nearly 1,900 miles an hour. But gravity
has its way. Not very successfully at first, but its best ally soon chips in. Friction. From the very first millisecond of its travel, air friction is slowing the bullet down and handing gravity a larger and larger say in its destiny. Friction and gravity work together to haul that bullet down. So you aim way high. You aim maybe 10 feet directly above the target, and 830 yards later, the curvature of the earth and the pull of its gravity bring that bullet home to where you want it. Except you don't aim directly above the target, because that would be to ignore meteorology. Bullets travel through air, and air moves. It's a rare day when the air is still. The air moves one way or another, left or right, up or down, or any combination. Reacher was watching the leaves on the trees, and he could see a slow, steady breeze coming out of the north. Dry air moving slowly right to left across his line of sight. So he was aiming about 8 feet to the right and 10 feet above where he wanted to put the bullet. He was going to launch that projectile and let nature curve it left and down. Human biology was all that stood in the way. Snipers are people. People are quivering, shuddering masses of flesh and muscle. The heart is beating away like a giant pump, and the lungs are squeezing huge volumes of air in and out. Every nerve and every muscle is trembling with microscopic energy. Nobody is ever still. Even the calmest person is vibrating like crazy. Say there's a yard between the rifle's firing pin and the muzzle. If the muzzle moves a tiny fraction, then 830 yards later, the bullet is going to miss by 830 tiny fractions. A multiplying effect. If the shooter's vibration disturbs the muzzle by even a hundredth of an inch, the bullet will be 8.3 inches off target, about the width of a man's head. So Reacher's technique was to wait, just to gaze through the sight until his breathing was regular and his heartbeat was slow, then to tighten the trigger fingers slowly and wait some more, then to count the heartbeats, 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. Keep on waiting until the rhythm was slow, then to fire between beats, right when the vibration was as small as a human being could get it. He waited. He breathed out long and slow. His heart beat once. It beat again. He fired. The stock jumped against his shoulder, and his view was obliterated by the blast of dust from the matting under the muzzle. The heavy thump of the shot crashed off the mountainsides and came back to him with a wave of whispering from the crowd. He had missed. The running, crouching screen print with FBI daubed on its chest was undamaged. He let the dust settle and checked the trees. The wind was steady. He breathed out and let his heart rate drop. He fired again. The big rifle kicked and crashed. The dust flew. The crowd stared and whispered. Another miss. Two misses. He breathed steadily and fired again. A miss. And again, another miss. He paused for a long time, picked up his rhythm again, and fired the fifth. He missed the fifth. The crowd was restless. Borkin lumbered nearer. "All on the last shot," he grinned. Reacher made no reply. No way could he afford the physical disturbance involved in speaking. The disruption to his breathing, the muscular contraction of his lungs and throat would be fatal. He waited. His heart beat. And again, he fired the sixth. He missed. He dropped the sight and stared at the plywood target. Undamaged. Borkin was staring at him, questions in his eyes. Reacher got to his knees and lifted the rifle, snapped the empty magazine out, pushed the bolt home, traced a finger along the neat engraving on the side of the stock, folded the bipod legs, laid the warm gun neatly on the matting. He stood up and shrugged. Borkin stared at him, glanced at Fowler. Fowler glanced back, puzzled. They had watched a man shooting for his life, and they had watched him miss every shot.
You knew the rules,
Porkin said quietly. Reacher stood still, ignored him, gazed up at the blue sky. A pair of vapor trails were crawling across it like tiny chalk lines far overhead in the stratosphere.
Wait, sir,
Joseph Ray called loudly. He came forward out of the crowd, bristling with urgency, self-important, things to say. He was one of the few men in the bastion with any actual military service behind him, and he prided himself on seeing things that other people missed. He thought it gave him an edge, made him useful in special ways. He looked hard at the matting and lay himself down exactly where Reacher had lain, glanced down the range to the targets, closed one eye and stared through half his field glasses like a telescope, focused on the screen print of the running man, moved his line of sight a fraction, and focused just beyond the hunch of the target's shoulder, stared into the distance, and nodded to himself.
Come on, he said.
He got to his feet and started jogging down the range. Fowler went with him. 830 yards later, Ray passed the target without a second glance, kept on jogging. Fowler followed. 50 yards. 100. Ray dropped to his knees and stared backward, aligned himself with the target and the matting way back in the far distance, turned and pointed forward, using his whole arm and finger like a rifle barrel, stood up again and walked 50 more yards to a particular tree. It was an orphan silver birch, a straggly wild survivor forcing its way up alongside the tall pines. Its trunk was contorted as it fought for light and air, one way and then the next. It was narrow, not more than 7 or 8 inches across. 6 feet from the ground, it had 6 bullet holes in it. Big, fresh, half-inch holes. 3 of them were in a perfect, straight, vertical line, maybe 7 inches high. The other 3 were curled in a loose curve to the right, running from the top hole out and back to the middle hole, and out and back again to the bottom hole. Joseph Ray stared hard at them. Then he realized what they were. He grinned. The 6 holes made a perfect capital B right there on the white bark. The letter covered an area of maybe 7 inches by 5, about the dimensions of a fat man's face. Fowler shouldered past Ray and turned and leaned on the trunk, stood and pressed the back of his head against the ragged holes, raised his field glasses and looked back down the range toward the matting. He figured he was more than 150 yards behind the target. The target had been more than 800 yards from the matting. He did the math in his head.
1,000 yards, he breathed.
Fowler and Joseph Ray paced it out together on the way back to Borkin. Ray kept his stride long, just about exactly 1 yard. Fowler counted. 990 strides, 990 yards. Borkin knelt on the matting and used Ray's field glasses. He closed one eye and stared across the distance. He could barely even see the white tree. Reacher watched him try to keep the surprise out of his face, thought to himself, you wanted a big performance, you got one. You like it, fat boy?
Okay,
Borkin said.
So let's see how damn smart you're going to act now.
The 5 guards, that had been 6 when Jackson was with them, formed up in a line. They moved forward and took up position around Reacher and Holly. The crowd started filing away, quietly. Their feet crunched and slid on the stony ground. Then that sound was gone and the rifle range was quiet. Fowler stooped and picked up the guns. He hefted 1 in each hand and walked away through the trees. The 5 guards unslung their weapons with the loud sound of palms slapping on wood and metal.
Okay,
Borkin said again.
Punishment detail.
He turned to Holly.
You too, he said. You're not too damn valuable for that. You can help him. He's got a task to perform for me.
The guards stepped forward and marched Reacher and Holly behind Borkin, slowly down through the trees to the bastion and on along the beaten earth track to the command hut clearing. They halted there. 2 of the guards peeled off and walked to the stores. They were back within 5 minutes with their weapons shouldered. The 1st guard was carrying a long-handled shovel in his left hand and a crowbar in his right. The 2nd was carrying 2 olive fatigue shirts. Borkin took them from him and turned to face Reacher and Holly.
Take your shirts off, he said. Put these on.
Holly stared at him.
Why?
She said. Borkin smiled.
All part of the game, he said. You're not back by nightfall. We turn the dogs loose. They need your old shirts for the scent.
Holly shook her head.
I'm not undressing, she said.
Borkin looked at her and nodded.
We'll turn our backs, he said. But you only get one chance. You don't do it, these boys will do it for you. Okay?
He gave the command, and the five guards fanned out in a loose arc, facing the trees. Borkin waited for Reacher to turn away, and then swiveled on his heels and stared up in the air.
Okay, he said. Get on with it.
The men heard unbuttoning sounds and the rasp of cotton. They heard the old shirt fall to the ground and the new one slipping on. They heard fingernails clicking against buttons.
Done,
Holly muttered. Reacher took off his jacket and his shirt and shivered in the mountain breeze. He took the new shirt from Borkin and shrugged it on, slung the jacket over his shoulder. Borkin nodded, and the guard handed Reacher the shovel and the crowbar. Borkin pointed into the forest.
Walk due west 100 yards, he said. Then north 100. You'll know what to do when you get there.
Holly looked at Reacher. He looked back and nodded. They strolled together into the trees heading west. 30 yards into the woods, as soon as they were out of sight, Holly stopped. She planted her crutch and waited for Reacher to turn and rejoin her.
Borkin, she said. I know who he is. I've seen his name in our files. They tagged him for a robbery, Northern California somewhere. $20 million in bearer bonds. Armored car driver was killed. Sacramento office investigated, but they couldn't make it stick.
Reacher nodded. He did it, he said. That's for damn sure. Fowler admitted it. Says they've got $20 million in the Caymans, captured from the enemy. Holly grimaced.
It explains the mole in Chicago, she said. Borkin can afford a pretty handsome bribe with $20 million in the bank, right?
Reacher nodded again, slowly. Anybody you know would take a bribe? He asked. She shrugged.
They all bitch about the salary, she said.
He shook his head.
Nah,
he said. Think of somebody who doesn't bitch about it. Whoever's got Borkin's bearer bonds behind him isn't worried about money anymore.
Some of them don't grumble, she said. Some of them just put up with it, like me, for instance. But I guess I'm different.
He looked at her, walked on.
You're different, he repeated. That's for damn sure.
He said it vaguely, thinking about it. They walked on for 10 yards. He was walking slower than his normal pace, and she was limping at his side. He was lost in thought. He was hearing Borkin's high voice claiming, "She's more than his daughter." He was hearing her own exasperated voice asking, "Why the hell does everybody assume everything that ever happens to me is because of who my damn father is?" Then he stopped walking again and looked straight at her.
"Who are you, Holly?" he asked.
"You know who I am," she said. He shook his head again.
"No, I don't," he said. "At first I thought you were just some woman. Then you were some woman called Holly Johnson. Then you were an FBI agent. Then you were General Johnson's daughter. Then Borkin told me you're even more than that." "She's more than his daughter," he said. "That stunt you pulled," he was shitting himself. "You're some kind of a AAA gold-plated hostage, Holly, so who the hell else are you?"
She looked at him, sighed.
"Long story," she said. "Started 28 years ago. My father was made a White House fellow, seconded to Washington. They used to do that with the fast-track guys. He got friendly with another guy, political analyst aiming to be a congressman. My mother was pregnant with me. His wife was pregnant. He asked my parents to be godparents. My father asked them to be godparents. So this other guy stood up at my christening."
"And?" Reacher said.
"The guy got into a career," Holly said. "He's still in Washington. You probably voted for him. He's the president."
Reacher walked on in a daze, kept glancing at Holly, gamely matching him stride for stride. 100 yards west of the punishment hut, there was an outcrop of rock, bare of trees. Reacher and Holly turned there and walked north into the breeze. Where are we going? Holly said. Her voice had an edge of worry. Reacher stopped suddenly. He knew where they were going. The answer was on the breeze. He went cold. His skin crawled. He stared down at the implements in his hands like he'd never seen such things before. You stay here, he said. She shook her head.
No, she said. I'm coming with you, wherever it is.
Please, Holly, he said. Stay here, will you? She looked surprised by his voice, but she kept on shaking her head.
I'm coming with you, she said again.
He gave her a bleak look, and they walked on north. He forced himself onward, toward it. 50 yards. Each step required a conscious effort of will. 60 yards. He wanted to turn and run. Just run and never stop. Hurl himself across the wild river and get the hell out. 70 yards. He stopped.
Stay here, Holly, he said again. Please.
Why? She asked.
You don't need to see this, he said, miserably.
She shook her head again and walked on. He caught her up. They smelled it long before they saw it. Faint, sweet, unforgettable. One of the most common and one of the most terrible smells in mankind's long and awful history. The smell of fresh human blood. 20 paces after they smelled it, they heard it. The buzzing of a million flies. Jackson was crucified between two young pines. His hands had been dragged apart and nailed to the trees through the palms and wrists. He had been forced up onto his toes, and his feet had been nailed flat against the base of the trunks. He was naked, and he had been mutilated. He had taken several minutes to die. Reacher was clear on that. He stood immobile, staring at the crawling mass of blue, shiny flies. Holly had dropped her crutch, and her face was white, ghastly, staring white. She fell to her knees and retched, spun herself away from the dreadful sight and fell forward on her face. Her hands clawed blindly in the forest dirt. She bucked and screamed into the buzzing forest silence, screamed and cried. Reacher watched the flies. His eyes were expressionless. His face was impassive. Just a tiny muscle jumping at the corner of his jaw gave anything away. He stood still for several minutes. Holly went silent on the forest floor beside him. He dropped the crowbar, slung his jacket over a low branch, stepped over directly in front of the body, and started digging. He dug with a quiet fury. He smashed the shovel into the earth as hard as he could. He chopped through tree roots with single savage blows. When he hit rocks, he heaved them out and hurled them into a pile. Holly sat up and watched him. She watched the blazing eyes in his impassive face and the bulging muscles in his arms. She followed the relentless rhythm of the shovel. She said nothing. The work was making him hot. The flies were checking him out. They left Jackson's body and buzzed around his head. He ignored them, just strained and gasped his way 6 feet down into the earth. Then he propped the shovel against a tree, wiped his face on his sleeve, didn't speak, took the crowbar and stepped close to the corpse, battered away the flies, levered the nails out of the left hand. Jackson's body flopped sideways. The left arm pointed grotesquely down into the pit. The flies rose in an angry cloud. Reacher walked around to the right hand, pried the nails out. The body flopped forward into the hole. Reacher extracted the nails from the feet. The body tumbled free into the grave. The air was dark with flies and loud with their sound. Reacher slid down into the hole and straightened the corpse out, crossed the arms over the chest. He climbed back out. Without pausing, he picked up the shovel and started filling the hole. He worked relentlessly. The flies disappeared. He worked on. There was too much dirt. It mounded up high when he had finished, like graves always do. He pounded the mound into a neat shape and dropped the shovel, bent and picked up the rocks he'd cleared, used them to shore up the sides of the mound, placed the biggest one on top like some kind of a headstone. Then he stood there, panting like a wild man, streaked with dirt and sweat. Holly watched him. Then she spoke for the first time in an hour.
"Should we say a prayer?" she asked.
Reacher shook his head. "Way too late for that," he said quietly.
"You okay?" she asked.
"Who's the mole?" he asked in turn.
"I don't know," she said.
"Well, think about it, will you?" he said angrily. She glared up at him.
"Don't you think I have been?" she said. "What the hell else do you think I was doing for the last hour?"
"So who the hell is it?" he asked, still angry. She paused, went quiet again.
"Could be anybody," she said. "There are 100 agents in Chicago."
She was sitting on the forest floor, small, miserable, defeated. She had trusted her people. She had told them that. She had been full of naive confidence. "I trust my people," she had said. He felt a wave of tenderness for her. It crashed over him. Not pity, not concern, just an agonizing tenderness for a good person whose bright new world was suddenly dirty and falling apart. He stared at her, hoping she would see it. She stared back, eyes full of tears. He held out his hands. She took them. He lifted her to her feet and held her. He lifted her off the ground and crushed her close. Her breasts were against his pounding chest. Her tears were against his neck. Then her hands were behind his head, pulling him close. She squirmed her face up and kissed him. She kissed him angrily and hungrily on the mouth. Her arms were locking around his neck. He felt her wild breathing. He knelt and laid her gently on the soft earth. Her hands burrowed at his shirt buttons, his at hers. They made love naked on the forest floor, urgently, passionately, greedily, as if they were defying death itself. Then they lay panting and spent in each other's arms, gazing up at the sunlight spearing down through the leaves. He stroked her hair and felt her breathing slow down. He held her silently for a long time, watching the dust motes dancing in the sunbeams over her head. "Who knew your movements on Monday?" he asked softly. She thought about it, made no reply. "And which of them didn't know about Jackson then?" he asked. No reply. "And which of them isn't short of money?" he asked. No reply. "And which of them is recent?" he asked. "Which of them could have come close enough to Bull Borkin somewhere to get bought off, sometime in the past? Maybe investigating the robbery thing in California." She shuddered in his arms. 4 questions, Holly," he said. "Who fits?" She ran through all the possibilities, like a process of elimination, an algorithm. She boiled the 100 names down. The first question eliminated most of them. The second question eliminated a few more. The third question eliminated a handful. It was the 4th question which proved decisive. She shuddered again.
"Only 2 possibilities," she said.